Are vegans actually unhealthy?
Does cannabis ruin your sleep?
And why are so many men taking testosterone supplements? I'm Mitch.
And I'm Greg.
And we're the creators of the popular YouTube channel ASAP Science.
Every week on our podcast Side Note by ASAP Science, we explain the science behind a controversial subject with recent research, up-to-date studies, and ridiculous stories so you are entertained while, bam, simultaneously learning.
We're here to make science make sense.
Download Side Note by ASAP Science wherever you get your podcasts.
A city exhaled yesterday. Just a bit, but it was badly needed.
We, myself, and the investigative team are pleased that Mr. MacArthur has pled guilty today, sparing the community and those who knew the victims a lengthy trial. I believe that this is the best possible outcome for the families and the community.
For about 2 years in Toronto, it has felt like the overwhelming question around the crimes that led to Bruce MacArthur's arrest has been, how much worse is this going to get? We started wondering it with dread after dogged reporting made it clear that men were vanishing in the Church Street village.
Three men disappeared over a 2-year span, but it's only now that investigators are now making any kind of connection.
We asked the same question after each new cry for help from the community.
The fact that there was a serial killer that was out there, the evidence does not point to that. The evidence does not suggest that.
We wondered it after every police press conference. First, when they said there was no reason to believe there was a serial killer operating, then...
This morning at approximately 10:25 a.m., police arrested 66-year-old Bruce MacArthur. He has been charged with 2 counts of first-degree murder in relation to Mr. Kinsman and Mr. Essen.
We wondered it after every revelation made plain just how long the hints and the warnings had been there waiting for investigators. We wondered it after every new charge, every new body, every announcement that police were spotted back at the Mallory Crescent property where the remains were found. And every time we asked it, it brought a new lurch of dread. For the city's LGBT community, for the families of the missing and dead men, for Toronto, which could only stare in horror, the specter of a public trial loomed like a gavel. All the evidence would be laid bare. The vultures of international media would swoop down on a grieving community. Imagine all the columns and opinion pieces and the creepily fascinated voyeurs learning about how the victims were stalked and preyed upon. It would have been a circus, and it would have broken Toronto in a very real way. So yes, the guilty plea that came Tuesday meant a tentative, shaky exhale. Now the city will be spared a trial, though, so a different question needs to be asked. Maybe it won't get worse, but how can it get better? How does a city recover from a crime that fractured an already tense relationship between the police and a vulnerable community? How does a space like Toronto's gay village that has served as a beacon for so many people fleeing prejudice and judgment start to feel safe again? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story. Momin Qureshi is a reporter at 680 News. He has been on the ground covering the MacArthur trial since the arrest.
I've been to almost every hearing he's had since then. I might have missed one or two along the way, but been at pretty much every one.
And made many visits to Mallory Crescent.
Yes.
There were a lot of whispers well before the arrest that something was happening. As someone who's a general assignment reporter for a newsroom, what kind of whispers were going on around there and what did you heard?
Well, I mean, it was definitely something that was being talked about a lot, particularly in the gay community, in the gay village here in Toronto. You know, men were disappearing from that community. People were feeling unsafe. There was a lot of talk about there potentially being a killer. The community was calling for it, kind of pushing police to look into it. There was some pushback from Toronto police against it. And then, of course, their worst fears were realized when MacArthur was arrested. Their fears were realized before that, but they came to, you know, fruition of it being a real thing when the police finally arrested MacArthur.
It feels like that was a moment that something changed in the relationship between the city's gay community and the police.
You know, it's definitely a relationship that's been in flux. If we see everything that's around this case, and then if you look at the ongoing back and forth about police in uniform participating in Pride,
right,
they've definitely had a fractured relationship over years. You go back to the bathhouse raids that happened a few decades ago. So the relationship between the gay community and Toronto police has certainly been fractured over time. I think Toronto police are, at this point right now, hyper aware and have worked really hard over the last year, particularly the detectives involved in this case, and really being in touch with the victims' families, with the community, trying to reach out, trying to get the information they need, not only to solve this case, but also at the same time try to mend some fences and move forward. I mean, I'm not deep inside the community enough to be able to say on behalf of the community how it's going, but I just know from the periphery, having covered some of this stuff, that is a little bit of what's happening.
Take me inside the courtroom yesterday. What happened?
Well, it was, you know, it's really interesting. If we can just go maybe to a day before that.
Sure.
It was kind of surprising because, like I said, I've covered almost every one of the hearings. And even the last hearing, which was just a couple of weeks ago, it was early this year, early 2019, the lawyers had said and the detectives had said that, oh, there's no plea yet. And in Canadian law, a plea generally happens closer to trial date, you know, just kind of the weeks and months leading up to trial date. And a trial date had been set for January of 2020.
Yeah.
So we felt that a plea could come and a guilty plea could come, but not until probably much later this year. So on Monday afternoon, when police sent out that release that said, just a heads up for the media, there's going to be a significant development tomorrow. And to most of us, that meant that a plea was coming in, most likely a guilty plea. Mm-hmm. It was pretty surprising. I mean, it kind of caught a lot of us off guard that that's how quickly it was going to happen. And then in the courtroom, they had put us in the largest courtroom in the province because they clearly were expecting there to be a large crowd. And there was pretty much every seat was full. So there was obviously a lot of journalists, but there was also lots of friends and family of the victims. A lot of the police officers that worked on this case, the detectives, the ones that were at Mallory doing all the digging and the excavating and a lot of the groundwork were there. So there was a lot of people who had a lot invested in this outcome in the courtroom. And it was very interesting to see the procedure because I've never been there for I've been there for a guilty verdict. I've never been there for a guilty plea. And it was interesting because going into the courtroom, nobody would confirm that that's what's going to happen. So we all kind of expected it to happen. But when the judge finally he kind of rolled into it very nonchalantly, this judge that was up there, he's handled a lot of stuff. I've covered cases where he's been up there and he's very in control, but he's also very relaxed when he does it. So there's no like big dramatics when he does it. He's very calm, very casual. And, you know, MacArthur was standing there in the holding box and he just said to him, okay, we understand you want to plead guilty. And that was the first time for us that we had heard it. So we all kind of like sat up, you know, as the reporters were like, oh, that's interesting. And he basically outlined for MacArthur, he said, before you do it, I have to kind of give you the rules. So I have to explain to you that you do not have to do this. You have every right to go to trial, stand trial, and then have the verdict come out. And he said, so you're waiving that. You understand that? He said, yes, I understand. He said, nobody is making you do this. You are doing this of your own volition. He said, yes, I understand. He said, do you understand that by pleading guilty here that you are essentially agreeing to a life sentence in prison because that is the automatic conviction for a first-degree murder? He said, yes, I understand that. So he kind of laid out all these rules for him.
Right.
And then he said, okay, as long as we have all that understood, that you know what you're doing it of your own sound mind and judgment, then, you know, the court, I don't know what position you have, but somebody inside the court, among the courtroom, basically then reads out all the charges one by one. So he wrote the dates, the times, the names of each of the victims, and then asked him, on this count, how do you plead? On this count, how do you plead? And each time, MacArthur, in kind of a very soft voice, said guilty each time. And so it was kind of surreal in a lot of ways to see it because I don't think since he was arrested, there's never been any doubt that he did it, right? Because police were very confident. Mm-hmm. I think they had all the information, you know, they had all the evidence, all the stuff for Mallory. So it was a pretty open and shut case that he was the one responsible, but it was still very strange to kind of see him up there and confess to it.
Yeah.
And really kind of seemingly out of nowhere, because even afterwards, Detective Dickinson, who was one of the lead detectives on the case along with Inspector Nzinga, said that we may never know what his motive was or why he came forward and just decided to plea.
Who were the victims? Because I feel like we're going to say Bruce MacArthur's name 50,000 times today and nobody's saying these men's names.
And I feel the same way. You know, it's having covered this a lot, I try as much as I can to put the names of the victims in there because, you know, they're the real, not only victims here, but the story as well.
I mean,
they should be the story. So their names are Sarush Mahmoodi, Skandaraj Navaratnam, Abdul Basir Faizi, Karushna Kanagaratnam, Salim Essen, Andrew Kinsman, Majid Kayan, and Dean Lisselwick. So those are eight men murdered over the course of 7 years between 2010 and 2017, most of them with connections to Toronto's gay village and from the LGBTQ community. Some of them had been in Canada for a long time. Some of them had only been here for a short time. MacArthur basically set up meetings with them and took advantage of them and committed murder.
You mentioned how much evidence there was.
Yeah.
What does it mean and how important is it that there won't be a trial?
You know, I think it means a lot. Just from a personal point of view, as somebody who's covered murder trials, covered some pretty heavy stuff before, you know, I covered some of the Della Millard hearing. I covered the Marco Muzzo hearing from start to finish. I was there for some of the Tory Stafford stuff. That stuff can be very graphic, very emotional, and very heavy on your brain, on your heart, on your soul, really, if you have to sit there and hear it. And that's just as a reporter on the periphery, kind of just hearing the details. Mm-hmm. But if you're a juror, just an average person from the public who's pulled in from this out of your, you know, you have no choice in the matter. You're just kind of pulled in as a civic duty, and you're put on that jury. If you're a lawyer, if you're somebody who has to be part of the courtroom staff, if you're a judge, any one of those people, and that's to say nothing of the family and the friends of the victims who are the real people you have to think about in a scenario like this. So the fact that none of those people, particularly the family and friends, have to sit there and hear day by day, because that trial was expected to last 3 or 4 months.
Yeah.
So that would have been 3 to 4 months of every day reliving part of that story. And we still will hear some of that stuff when they read the statements of fact next week, when he goes back to court next week. But it won't have to be on a day by day basis for 4 months.
You told us about the mood inside the courthouse. As soon as that court let out, what was the mood outside like? How are people reacting? Are they relieved? Because I feel like the city is relieved.
I think relief is a good word to pick. I think a lot of people are relieved, relieved in a lot of ways. So I was looking at a lot of the Toronto police officers, a lot of the detectives. They seem to have a weight off their shoulders. They know their work isn't done just yet. But, you know, I think they're relieved that they don't have to go through this whole process over the next year and a bit, that they've been able to bring some relief to the families. Because even though I would guess that most of the families of these victims know that MacArthur's the guy that did it, it's another thing for him to stand up and say, I did it.
Yeah.
You know, and that he didn't even have to be convicted, that he stood up and said, yep, I'm the one that did it. So there is a certain amount of, I think, relief that comes with that. I don't know about closure. I think closure can take a lot of time and several years. But in the immediate aftermath, when we walked out into the hallway right outside the courtroom, you could see a lot of people breathing easy. I did see a few people leaving the courtroom with tears in their eyes. Mm-hmm. Those are some of the friends and families of those victims. Understandably, it's a lot to handle, especially since they read those brief statement of facts with some of those kind of really disturbing details in it. And then outside the courtroom, you know, Detective Dickinson talked to us. We also spoke to the woman who owns the house on Mallory Crescent. And she was so well-spoken and eloquent and well thought out.
I don't know if I believe in the word closure. I think possibly an easing is all you get. Not for me, closure won't happen. But the way I'm trying to look at it, the man I knew actually didn't exist. So that's the best I can go with. This is someone else entirely.
Her name is Karen Fraser, and she lives there with her partner, and she's lived in that house for years. She is sort of one of the people that is sort of almost an accidental victim in all this. You know, of course, the 8 men who were murdered are the actual victims, and their families are the ones that are suffering. But for her, she just is kind of like an accidental victim, because she had struck up this kind of agreement of relationship with MacArthur, where like they would go away and MacArthur would just take care of their property when they would go to their cottage. And of course, he completely used her to hide these victims and stuff like that. But, you know, she had the misfortune of meeting a couple of the men that were murdered and having to live on this now infamous property. And to her credit, she's really trying to take ownership back of it, you know, in a figurative way. Obviously, she still owns the property, but she's trying to make it that it's not just the property where MacArthur hid the bodies of these 8 victims or the remains of these 8 victims, that it's her home, that it's a house of love. You know, I can't remember what exactly it says, but she painted this beautiful kind of statement on her garage about love and kindness. Last week on the 1 year anniversary of MacArthur's arrest, she had a lone bagpiper come and play on her driveway and invited all the reporters to come out. And then a few people spoke.
What's going on in the community on Church Street? Because that's been, if it's been awful on anybody besides the families, it's been that community.
Yeah, I mean, that entire community, you know, for years has been talking about this. They've, like we mentioned, you know, they've had a bit of a fractured relationship with police. And
well, they were yelling about people going missing for months and years.
Absolutely, yeah. And, you know, especially in the early months of this stuff. So I remember in January, February, March of last year, there was a lot of people that would come to the first few hearings for MacArthur, not only to see him, see what he looks like, and be there for the hearings, but also to speak to us afterwards, because they wanted to voice their displeasure with the police and kind of say, we've been telling you for how long that this is a problem. So now that he's pled guilty, I think that it'll be really interesting to see how the LGBTQ community reacts to this, how they go forward, how their relationship with Toronto Police is. I think the Chief Mark Saunders, is very aware that that relationship is fractured at the moment. You know, of course, we add in as an adjacent thing to it what's happening with Pride and uniformed officers not being allowed to march. So
how closely are those two things tied together? Because it feels like a lot of the relationship between on both sides.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I mean, I'm not a member of that community, so it's hard for me to say. I don't think you can say they're unrelated, but I don't know necessarily that they're completely joined at the hip either. But I mean, look, those are two prominent things that affect the same community in our city, and they kind of tie into the same thing in the sense that people from the LGBTQ community feel that their relationship with Toronto Police and the way they're treated with Toronto Police isn't what it should be, or exactly what it should be, or isn't where it needs to be, and that it needs to get to that place, but it's not going to get to that place overnight, and it's going to take time. You know, I interviewed Olivia Nuama, who is the executive director of Pride, last week, and she said, look, we've closed the door for 2019. Police uniformed officers will not take part in this year's parade, and we don't know about the future, but we want to have that dialogue and work really hard. So in this case, with the MacArthur investigation and now admission of guilt, I imagine it's also the same thing. It'll take time. The police can't snap their fingers and make it happen, and nor does the community, you know, have to open their hearts right away and forgive. It'll take time. It'll take time, and it's not for me or anybody else who is straight or not of that community to say that they should hurry it up. They got to get there when they get there, and they got to work it out with Toronto Police on their own.
Even beyond the church community, this seemed like a crime that kind of horrified everybody. Why did everybody in Toronto become captivated by the MacArthur case?
Yeah, this is certainly one that gripped everybody. I don't think only in the city, I think really coast to coast.
Yeah.
But particularly in the city, for obvious reasons. I mean, look, LGBTQ community, because it directly impacted them and members of their community. Then you have to remember that MacArthur was a landscaper. So he was working at dozens of properties across the GTA. So it's possible that if you own a home in Scarborough or Etobicoke or Newmarket or wherever, he possibly did work on your property. And if you are there, if you had kids and they were running around playing outside or something and he was there, you know, that's the kind of thing that can potentially keep you up at night or at least give you the shivers.
He was entwined with the city.
Yeah. He was a mall Santa in 2017, just weeks before he was arrested for murder.
Oh.
He was the mall Santa at Agent Court Mall in Scarborough. So there's parents out there who potentially had his photo up on their fridge with their kids sitting on his lap, you know, and then, you know, just 2 or 3 weeks later, you're looking at that photo and that guy is in prison awaiting, you know, trial for murder. It's one of those things that can really rattle your brain and kind of scare you and affect you. And even if you weren't directly impacted by the landscaping or the mall Santa or being part of the LGBTQ community, he has that. We've all seen that photo of him smiling at Niagara Falls. You know, he just looks like a guy that, you know, even people that knew him say that he was a really friendly guy. He's a really jovial guy. So it kind of creates that. Do you really ever know somebody?
What is a lesson that the police, the city, and everyone else can take away from how this happened and why it was so long to be discovered?
Well, you know, I think there's lots of lessons that can be learned. And even Detective Dickinson said that there is a lot of lessons to be learned. I think, you know, they have to really work on, Toronto Police has to work on the relationship with the LGBTQ community.
Right.
I think that when people are making those types of cries, maybe you have to really look seriously at it a little quicker. And I mean, it's easy for us to say because we're not Toronto Police, right? We don't know how often people are calling them saying that something's going
on. Sure, and someone goes missing, everybody calls the police.
Sure.
But
there's a lot to be learned here in terms of heeding people's warnings, paying attention to certain communities. Police, once they were on MacArthur's trail, really did a good job in terms of tracking him down and arresting him and you know, all the evidence they put together. But I think this is a case that isn't closed by any means, because even, you know, Detective Dickinson talked about how they're still looking into cold cases. They're still talking to other jurisdictions because they don't know, because MacArthur hasn't really helped them out.
My next question, yeah, right? So he pled guilty to 8 murders.
Right.
For almost a year, we kept hearing the police are back searching for more remains and there may be more victims. Does that stop now? What happens next?
So a number of times over the last year, I or some of my colleagues, when Inspector Itzinga has spoken to us, have asked, is MacArthur being helpful? And he doesn't ever want to talk about it. He's never really addressed that question, at least in any of the scrums that I've been in. And I think that's partly because MacArthur wasn't being helpful and wasn't telling them anything. But now that he's confessed to it and pled guilty, it's possible that could change. I don't know. I'm not on the inside. But I know he didn't really, from what I know, he didn't really help them out a lot over the past year. And that's why they were going through 100 different properties. That's not an exaggeration. That is an actual number. They were looking at over 100 properties in the GTA and just beyond the GTA that he had worked at. If he had helped them, it probably wouldn't have been that big of a number. Not to say that you should necessarily take the words of an accused killer as fact, but I mean, I don't think he was really helping them narrow it down. So, I mean, I guess Toronto Police may get some help from him, or maybe this is all he did. Like, he committed the 8 murders, and that's where the list stops. But I guess time will really tell.
And the agreed statement of facts will be out next week sometime.
So next week's going to be a big week and a very emotional week. It was a little emotional in the courtroom, but next week they're going to do the agreed statement of facts, which is going to be very in detail about the 8 different murders, what happened, how it happened, you know, all that kind of stuff. And then also family members and friends will get up and read what's called a victim impact statement. And they'll be able to address it directly to Bruce MacArthur. He is also, I believe, at a point going to be able to allowed to get up and speak. Whether he will or won't, we don't know. So it's going to be very, very emotional. That's expected to last 3 days next week. And then after that, the judge will decide what the sentence will be, and he'll come back at a later date and decide what the sentence is. And they can decide to do 8 consecutive, 8 concurrent,
right.
Some mishmash of that. Either way, whatever the decision is made, it is highly, 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 highly unlikely that Bruce MacArthur will ever get parole to walk out the doors of a prison. Whether he gets 1 life sentence or 8, doesn't matter. He's never coming out.
Thanks, Momin.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Momin Qureshi is a 680 News reporter. That was The Big Story, brought to you by Scotia iTrade. You can visit ScotiaiTrade.com to start direct investing today. And you can visit us at thebigstorypodcast.ca or along with our brother and sister shows at frequencypodcastnetwork.com. You can hit up contact us forms on both those websites to tell us about stories we should be covering. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. Thanks for listening. We'll talk tomorrow.
I'm Laura Palmer, host of Island Crime. Season 6, Sweethearts, is the story of 3 teenage girls who were all murdered in Victoria, Canada, within about 12 months.
So she was scared. Something out there scared her.
You've just created the playground where predators can really thrive.
She was a 16-year-old girl. She was a sweetheart.
Listen to Sweethearts at frequencypodcastnetwork.com or wherever you get podcasts.
Find your frequency.